In the morning, Salino and Calillo went to visit Sophie Dickman in her home. In a calm, collected manner, she told them exactly what had happened, how had she been awakened, with delight in her eyes, the gun, and the ransacking, the rape. She described her assailant as being white, tall and thin, with bad teeth. She said he was dressed in black and that he was good looking. They thought it was an odd way to describe a rapist. She worked with a police artist to help create a likeness sketch of her assailant. When the public, just after Dickman and Nelson's assault, fully comprehended who was walking freely among them, a collective terror was born, the likes of which had never been seen in Southern California. The sale of guns, guard dogs, window gates and alarm systems soared. Locksmith had been so busy in gun stores, people lined up, three deep. A gun salesman in Northridge said,
"I had wall-to-wall people to the ceiling wanting guns for protection. Never saw anything like it."
Editorial screen for the capture of the Valley Intruder. Mayor Tom Bradley, Sheriff Block, and Police Chief Darryl Gates all said his apprehension was imminent. When the news made learn that Frank Salerno of the Hillside Stranglers fame was running the task force for this new serial killer in Los Angeles, which the press had dubbed the Night Stalker, they wouldn't leave him alone. He and Soon Caldwell as well were hounded by reporters as they came and went. They couldn't answer the phone anymore because so many reporters were calling from all over the world, as far away as England, Israel, and Brazil. Calio thought it would be a good idea if he did video about the crimes of all the LA County police departments. It would help centralize the investigation and make clear the evidence tying all the crimes together. The killer's MO, aka modus operandi, his description. Salino thought that this was a great idea, and Carlo went to the sheriff's media resource center and taped a 29 piece laying out what they had. Copies of the television show were sent to all LA sheriff's stations. The tape was done a day after the Nelson murder, and it shows how exhausted Callie was. His voice is hoarse and strained. It was a day finally that the LAPD let the sheriff's office have the car officer Stavros had pulled over. It had been in an outdoor police parking lot, and any left prints behind had been burned away by the scorching California sun. Salino and Calillo learned for the first time about the dentist appointment card in a wallet and six phone numbers in a little black phone book. LAPD said they were subpoenaing the phone company to learn the identity and the addresses of people whose numbers were found. This Salino knew was the first and biggest break they had. All LAPD had to do was find out who belonged to these numbers, put the people who belong to these numbers under surveillance and wait. It was just a matter of time. The dentist's appointment was in the name of Richard Mena, which proved to be an alias. The two homicide detectives went to visit the dentist. Dr. Peter Long, a non-nonsense Asian who ran the dental clinic that opened at 7 a.m. and closed at 9 p.m. 7 days a week. He said Richard Mena had abscesses and was in pain and should be back. He had come in for treatment on July 3rd and was weeks gone after he'd gotten away from Star Ross. Carlio and Sally Noor realized that had the dentist's office had been stocked out right away, it should have been they have caught the serial killer on July the 3rd. They asked the doctor if they would be okay if the sheriff's office placed undercover detectives in the dentist office, including so they would wait to see if Richard Mena, the alias name he was using, came back. Leung, the dentist, didn't like the idea, saying,
"It is disruptive and a nuisance, but finally it is a quest. It is needed. If there is a serial killer walking about, I will helpfully help you, LAPD, when the man comes in, Richard Mena."
They would have to be, he stipulated, of Asian ancestry, for most of his practice were Asian. They agreed, and two Asian detectives from the sheriff's office were planted in Dr. Leung's office. They were told many times over by both Saleno and Carrillo not to take any chances that the guy they were looking for was a stone-cold killer who knew what he was doing and would move very fast, very decisively. From when Dr. Leung opened his office to when he closed, detectives' guns at the ready and keyed up waited for Richard Mena to show. If he grabbed for a weapon, he'd be dead before he hit the ground. Saliono and Carlino felt very positive about the success of the operation. Dr. Leung said Mena had a condition which absolutely needed attention and was very painful. They reasoned if he came back once after being stopped, he could come back again. Gary assured Mena's x-rays to a friend who was a dentist, and he confirmed what Dr. Leung had said. This guy will need medical attention soon. At that point, they had no way of being certain Mena was the intruder, though his description and modus operandi matched the abductions where the Avia shoe prints had been found. The sheriff's task force began to grow in size, ferocity, purpose and focus. Lines of communication were finally being opened. All LA police jurisdictions, tips and leads pouring into the sheriff's office had to be followed up on. Saleno assigned Bumcrot and Robinson to run down every Richard Mena in the criminal justice system, which turned out to be 40 individuals. One of the biggest clues was his teeth and feet. That's what they were focused our energy on, Salina would say. Indeed, Bunkrat and Robinson were checking out the 40 Richard Menez in their computers. They were so busy looking at their feet and shoes that Bunkard said they really come across the Stalker, he had gotten the drop on them for sure. Similar task forces were put together by LAPD and the Monterey Park Police at station houses all over LA County. Cops going out on patrol were shown to video Calio had made. Many of the tape showed of the killer to be on their dashboards. There would be promotion and adulation for the cop who caught him. He'd be an instant hero. They all knew how terribly vicious he was, and finding the Night Stalker became the top priority in every LAPD cop's mind. Calio continued to sleep alone with his gun near the bed. Salino, too, took precautions. His face and name and reputation had been shown all over newspapers and news and broadcasts. For all he knew, the Night Stalker might decide to come looking for him or his family. Salino would not underestimate him. He had two well-trained hunting Labrador retrievers who barked when strangers came around. To make certain his dogs didn't miss anything, he tied garbage cans to the two doors to the left and to the right of the house that led to the yard and the rear bedrooms. Salino also took sleeping with his gun near the bed. Frank Jr. was working as a deputy sheriff at the time and was still living in the house. He also slept with a gun near the bed. If the Night Stalker came by the Salino house, he would leave in a body bag. The Night Stalker would make Salino leave in a body bag. On July the 13th, Sophie Dickman went to a town meeting called the Monterey Park Police, held by at the city council chambers. The police were shocked by how many people showed up. Nearly 2,000, and this was without any formal notice. They had expected just block captains to come, but once the word got around, people couldn't get away. Lieutenant Joe Santoro was the first to address the frightened citizens of LA and all its suburbs and towns nearby. He told them about the crimes the killer committed outside Monterey Park. They were, he conceded, more attacks in Monterey Park than in any other community. He said Plango's detectives were now cruising the streets of Monterey Park at all hours of the night. If he came back to their city, he would zip-zock from Los Angeles to Monterey Park to any village or town surrounding LA or Monterey Park to kill his victims. He told the audience that the Stalker enjoyed hurting his victims, that mutilation was very vicious, sexual assaults occurred. He works at night. If you see or hear anything suspicious, don't hesitate. Call us because he comes at night. Practice dialing 911 all alone in the dark. Know where your phone is and keep it within arm's reach and keep your curtains closed. When Sophie Dickman heard Ellie, the Lieutenant Santiago, talk about the realities of her assailant's viciousness, she realized how fortunate she had been. She had been trained to deal with psychopaths, and she realized she'd still been very lucky. She wanted to get up and tell everyone what had happened to her, but how he was suddenly standing over her, leering down at her, snarling, raping, but she remained seated and listened to Lieutenant Santoro. There are, he said, hundreds of detectives right now looking for him. We'll get him soon. In the meantime, you can't be too cautious. On July 17th, Mabel Bell died of wounds she had suffered at the killer's hands. On May 29th, 2 months earlier, Dr. Sarah Redley did the autopsy. In her report, she noted the cause of death, a massive brain trauma. Detective Robertson and Brokop never had the chance to question her. Nettie remained in a comatose state and was being fed through tubes and tubes as she could not feed herself. The stalker read with great interest, laughing, as the news accounts of his assault. When he first saw them, he casually passed a downtown newsstand. He stopped still and was in shock, his stomach turning and his heart racing. He had no idea they had connected all his crimes. He had bought the newspapers and he listened to heavy metal music, reading them in the roach-infested hotel room with windows too dirty to be seen through. The stories said nothing of the Avia footprints or the ballistic matchups. He knew, though, that he had been much more careful from now on, and it was getting hot for him. Yet he stayed in LA and planned new, more horrific crimes. It was now, after the Nelson and Dickman attacks, that he made up his mind to take what he was doing to a new level, one that would shock and horrify the world in a way never known before. He wanted everywhere, everyone, everywhere, in every place to know of his power. On July 20th, a detective waited for him in the dentist Dr. Lung's office as all cops over Southern California looked for him. He casually went into the downtown knife store, Ross Cutterly, and bought an industrial machete. He was going to remove the heads of his next victims and leave them on the front lawn for the police to find. That, he figured, would show them who they were fucking with. With his pass key, he stole another Toyota and got on the freeway system, drifting north this time to Glendale, a large community with a population of 170,000, ringed by Vedula Mountains and Angela Bruno's hometown, the Hillside Stranglers' hometown. Glendale was the third largest city in Los Angeles County, founded in 1880, and a quick 6 miles north of Los Angeles. The people in the Chamber of the Commerce like to say it was a great place to work and invest. After getting off the freeway, he slowly cruised the Glendale streets, lined with darkened lawns and palm trees, cypress and acacia trees. He parked the Toyota on Stanley Avenue and Zay Court, shut off the engine, turned off the lights, and listened to the silence carefully. Here in Glendale, he sensed he had to have what he had converted and craved. He tied his shoelaces tightly and tucked his pants in his socks so that he wouldn't get caught on anything. got out the car and walked towards the home of Maxon and Leela, kneeling. One block from the freeway, he stood still and let his hyperkeen senses fear the night. A fog had rolled in and hung 2 feet above the sidewalk. He was fascinated by fog. It reminded him of the stories he read about Jack the Ripper. He decided this was the place and walked to the front windows. Shit, they were fucking locked, as was the front door. He went around the back of the house, where a beige stucco with a slanted terracotta tiled roof, 2 large orange trees filled with fruit grew in the front yard. In the rear of the house, all the windows were locked. The kneelings had been following the crimes of the Night Stalker in the local news, and they were not keeping their windows open. The horrible assaults of Mabel Bell and Nettie Lang had upset them deeply. He cut the screen of the French window door, reached in a large gloved hand, and easily opened the lock. But he didn't enter the house. Instead, after he opened the French window door, he went back to his car, to the Toyota, for his machete. Walking quickly but quietly, all his senses sharpened and more defined, he retrieved the large blade and returned to the yard, keeping his hand down, with the machete hidden in the fog, which swirled around his legs as he moved. Before he entered the house, he knelt on the ground and prayed to Satan. "By all that is evil, I am your humble servant. Invoke Satan to be here and accept this offering." Staying low, he entered. The kneeling resident remained statue still, then moved straight to the kneeling's bedroom. Max Kneeling was 68 and Leela, 66, had been married 47 years. They were high school sweethearts and had been married shortly after graduating. They had 3 children and 13 grandchildren. Max owned a service station. Leela worked for a security force at the Robinson's department store. They made a nice living and were comfortable. She was an avid Dodgers and Lakers fan and would often listen to the games on the radio while doing chores so she could enjoy the games. Max was a hard-working man who was a deacon at the Glendale Seventh-day Adventist Church. They had been one another for 50 years and were as much in love today as they'd been when they first ever met. As always, the stalker found out who was in the house. When he realized it was just Max and Leela, he entered the bedroom, turned on the lights, walked straight to the bed, kicked it and said, "Rise and shine, motherfuckers!" Max put it up, not believing his eyes, shocked, startled, seeing death as clearly as an oncoming train in the soldier of Satan's face. Leela screamed. The killer swung with a machete, its blade hissing the air like a poisonous snake, and struck Max in the neck, giving him a deep gash. The stalker had thought the head would come off, but it didn't. Max went down, pleading for him to stop. Instead, he swung viciously at Layla and missed. The machete wasn't sharp enough to kill them quickly, he realized, and he pulled out a .22 caliber, put it right to Max's head, and pulled the trigger. Bang! But no bang. The gun had jammed. As they pitifully begged not to be killed, he cleared it again, put the gun to Max's head, and bang! Fired, and ending Max's life instantly. Layla screamed hysterically. He put the gun to her face, pulled the trigger 3 times, killing her. They were both still. He proceeded to cut them and jab them with a machete and ransacked the house. He had a scanner with him. Over it, he heard a report of
shots fired, let's go out.
Quickly, he put what he wanted into a pillowcase and walked to the back of the Toyota, his car waiting, carrying the bloody machete in one hand and the needed possessions in the other. With the fog surrounding him, he got into the stolen Toyota, pulled away as the police car began slowly to cruise the block. In 30 seconds, he was back on the freeway, and in minutes was at Fence's house, getting rid of Nadine's valuables, a radio, a camera, a VCR, watches, rings, and other jewelry. The Fence saw blood on him, but said nothing of him being the killer in the paper. If he really was the killer, he was dangerous beyond words, the Fence knew. So he kept quiet and woodenly went about doing business with him. Soon, however, he would stop dealing with him. There was just too much blood on everything he brought him. And if he was the killer, there would be a big reward. He called the police, and that's what he thought about now. He took the needing loot. Still not satisfied, the stalker again drove north. After he scored some meth off the dealer, a quarter of the moon, mostly night sky, he got off Sun Valley exit on the freeway, began to cruise the pristine community of 60,000. The town had been known as Roskio until 1948, when the public referendum overwhelmingly voted a change a name to Sun Valley. This is at the same night as he sold his stuff to the drug dealer to get his meth. The same night he'd committed that double homicide. It was now 4:15 a.m. On this night, the city of Sun Valley was soundly sleeping. Everyone there knew about the murderous assaults on people's homes, but they had never been one in Sun Valley, which was much farther north than any other of the Night Stalker's attacks. The people of Sun Valley felt removed from the danger of the stalker. He found his way to Charbonne Street, shut off the lights and the engine of the Toyota, and coasted to a noiseless stop. He decided this would be a good place. Got out of the Toyota and walked up Charbonne, leaving the machete in the Toyota. There was no fog in Sun Valley. He stopped when he reached the home. He had a puff on a meth pipe as he approached and came off Shillong. Some kid gone off a modest L-shaped house with a garage and a curved driveway. He smoked his last pipe of meth as he entered the garage of the driveway. She ran along. Konafaf was an immigrant from Thailand who who had come to California 10 years earlier. He worked long hours as a parking attendant. He was a handsome man with thick black hair who dearly loved his wife and his children, an 8-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl. His hobby was gardening. He spent many hours in the backyard of the house. Some kid had to be born in Thailand, and like her husband, she immigrated to Los Angeles 10 years earlier in May of 1975. Her first year in LA, she had met and married Shena Rong, petite and very pretty. Some kid, large round dark eyes and short, thick black hair. The stalker walked to the front of the Shervonovash residence and tried the windows and the door. As before, at the other house, they were all locked. He went to the back of the house and saw the beautiful garden that Shena Rong had created with love and patience. Got down low and made sure the vibrations were right. He smoked another meth pipe. Heightened senses, he was satisfied. All was clear, including his mind now. He tried the sliding glass doors. They were open, and he silently slipped into the den. There was a nightlight on. Some kid had been sleeping in the couch or the den. She was a very light sleeper, and his present, his sudden movement, woke her. He ran to her, put his hands over her mouth, trembling. She stared at him with huge, frightened, liquid black eyes. He put a gun, a 25 auto, to her head. "Do not make a fucking sound, bitch, or I'll kill you, understand?" Crying, she nodded. He left her, found the two sleeping children in different rooms. They went to Shena Rong, who was snoring loudly as he slept. There was a fan on the dresser facing the bed, and it slowly loomed back and forth, offering little relief from the heavy, clawing heat. The stalker walked straight to the bed and put the barrel of the gun 1 inch from Shena Rong's left ear and pulled the trigger. There was a muffled pop as the 25 slug zigzagged through Shena Rong's brain, killing him instantly. As the blood poured from the wound, the stalker covered him with a blanket and went back to some kid, anxious to terrorize and rape her. She had taken off her diamond wedding ring and hidden it in the couch. He immediately noticed her doing it, hiding her ring. The night stalker took off his gloves and slapped her hand, putting the glove right back on. "Do not play no fucking games, bitch. Where's the fucking ring I saw you take off?" She told him it was inside the couch. He found it and put it in his pocket, then viciously ripped off her filmy nightgown, grabbed her arm, and dragged her to the bathroom. He picked up a hairdryer. "What are you going to do with that?" "I need a knife." "A knife? Why?" "To cut this cord." Together they went to the kitchen, where he found a butcher knife and severed the cord from the dryer. He took her back to the bathroom, tied her hands behind her back with the wire cord from the dryer. He took her to the bedroom where her dead husband laid and raped her in front while she was watching her dead husband. She was being raped. She was terrified, and her fear turned him on and excited him as his meth drug fueled rage and his sexual appetite totally brought a euphoric feeling to this crazed killer. If she had resisted, she would have put up a fight, defied him, he would have killed her. An alarm clock in the 8-year-old's room went off. He tied her legs with the cord from the dryer in the kitchen and ran into the boy's room, bound and tied him, put the sock in his mouth. He left the boy's room and began his frenzic ransacking. Soon he came back to her and made her sit in a chair, and euphoric a feeling he had. To add to his euphoria, he sodomized her, then climaxed and demanded jewelry and money. She told him where a jewelry box was, but there was nothing except costume pieces in it, which infiltrated him, angered him. He dragged her by the hair around the house, cussing at her, slapping her, viciously kicking her. Where's the good stuff? Where's the motherfucking cash? Where the fucking cash? He demanded. She told him where her purse was. He found $80 and pocketed it. I killed your husband, okay? I killed you and your fucking kids. Now where's the fucking valuable things, bitch? He said.
If I give you everything, will you go?
Yeah, I'll go. She told him she had hidden her value pieces in the kitchen. He dragged her there. Some kid showed him her secret hiding place, an envelope hidden behind a drawer. In it were rubies, diamonds, a diamond bracelet, and a ring. Some kid's brother was a jeweler, and she had some unique, very valuable pieces. With a smile on his face, he took them all. And where is the money? No money, no money. I swear to God. No, bitch, you swear to Satan. I swear to Satan. No money, I swear to Satan. Say it right now, bitch. I swear to Satan, say it. He dragged her, still naked and still bound, back to the bedroom and raped her. 3 times over and over again. There was time when he had discovered a fortune in gold, Quran coins, Thailand currency in the trunk of the stolen car. And now, after the third rape, he wanted to go outside so he could look further in the trunk of the car for cash. In order to open the garage door from inside the house, a button on the wall in the bathroom had to be pushed. Some kid showed it to him, but he wouldn't push it because he thought it was some kind of police panic alarm. He put a gun to her head and told her he'd kill her and her kids if she tricked him. She repeatedly swore on Satan she wasn't trying to trick him. He pushed the button. The garage door automatically opened and they went outside. He put a robe on her. All he found in the car was $15 in Thailand currency in a wallet underneath the driver's seat. Back inside, he slapped her and demanded more valuables. She told him about the piece of jewelry she had hidden in her son's blue jacket in half closet. He went and retrieved it, a gold brooch with diamonds. He made her swear on Satan that there was nothing more. When she did, he laughed, laid her down, tied her ankles together with a belt. Finally, he put his booty into a large suitcase of theirs and silently exited, leaving some kid tied on the bedroom floor. When she saw he was gone, she freed herself, ran to her son, and made certain he was okay, then went to the back room, lifted the blanket, and saw the bullet inside Sharon's head. I knew it was true that he really had murdered his beloved husband, even though she knew that when she was getting raped, so I don't understand that. She began to shake and sob, but she knew she had to keep her composure for the sake of her children. Quicker, she gathered them and ran from the house, crossed the street, and frantically rang the bell of a neighbor. As we continue with the story.